there's no better feeling than a personal win. And the State Farm Personal Price Plan can help you do just that. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Shouldn't you be at work?
When the seagulls follow the trawler, it's because they think sardines will be thrown into the sea.
I will love it if we beat them. Love it.
I'll have a low-fat pizza or something like that, or a few biscuits and some milk on a Sunday.
And you can pair up if you like. And you can fucking pick someone else to help you, and you can bring your fucking dinner.
Go left! Hit left! Hit left over the top! Now!
Now, you know him better than anybody, probably. Do you back him to score quickly, yes or no?
Yes.
Tony Hatton!
No!
Hello and welcome to Quickly Kevin, Will He Score, the 90s football show. I am Chris Gold, joining me my co-host Josh Widdicombe.
Hello.
And more 90s than trapping your fingers in a car door, it's Michael Marden.
Hello.
That was big in the 90s, wasn't it?
It was. Do you remember the fake plastic fingers out the boot?
Did you ever see the whole arm? There was a whole arm.
Was there a whole arm?
A whole arm.
No, I liked the fingers out the boot. It was funny. My gran had them. They went mouldy, though, so the realism was lost.
Unless it was a real corpse.
Yeah. Unless it was a real corpse, yeah.
Do you know, you could have double fingers out of the boot as well. I saw that a few times.
Oh, that's what she had, the double fingers.
A double. Do they come as a set, or do you buy them separately?
I don't know, actually.
Hello at quicklykevin.com.
Do I remember this right?
Thank you, everybody, for listening. We found out last week that we've been nominated for Best Sports Podcast in the British Podcast Awards. Yeah. Thank you for sharing in our success. Unfortunately, you can't vote for it or vote for us because it is a proper award ceremony. Anyway, let's crack on with some correspondence.
I'm Jim Rosenthal, and this is the Electronic Postbag.
You've got mail.
Right, here is a new section that I'm calling, I can't decide on the title, The Witter Fry, Fry as a Kite, or Frying with Laughter. You can decide for yourself which one this is called. We've got a cracking email here about Barry Fry.
Can I just stop you? Michael, don't do a jingle.
Just the sound of something sizzling and then Barry Fry laughing.
Well, that's a jingle I want to make. I'm going to defy you.
Great going forward, Foxy at the back, mate.
I can't keep a good man down.
We've got a cracking email about Barry Fry from John Paul Stevenson. I recently listened to the episode on There's Only One Barry Fry and felt compelled to tell you a story my dad told me a few years ago, around 2002. In the documentary, Barry Fry randomly turns up at 102.7 Hereward FM, my childhood radio station. At the time, my dad worked at the radio station as a technician and working on the day of the Barry Fry visit, Barry Fry Day. Apparently, Fry was so excited when
Just for the listeners, if you haven't listened to that episode, that's what Barry Fry called it, not what John Paul Stevenson's calling it.
Apparently, Fry was so excited when he entered the building, he walked in whistling, "If I Only Had a Brain" from The Wizard of Oz. Why would you...
Could I just quickly tell a story, very quickly, about a friend... Someone told me that their friend worked on a small local radio station, like Herald FM.
Yeah.
And she was, working in the office at, 10 p.m. or whatever. She was the only one in there. And she needed to charge her phone. So she just unplugged something, plugged it in. Someone ran out of the studio, "We've gone down, we're off air." Anyway, carry on.
I've got a local radio story. So I used to work for Time FM 102.7 in Romford, and I had to interview like managers for like Red Bridge and like local, really small like Billericay at the time, like really small teams. And the guy who ran the station said, "I'm going to show you how to interview managers." And he just did a standard interview, like, "Oh, what do you think of the game today?" It was just on the phone, like down the line. And at the end, he went, "I think the team had won." And he went, "So I imagine you and the boys are going to have a few pints tonight." And the manager went, "Oh, yes, we will." And then he ended the interview and went, "Always end on a joke." That's how quickly Kevin began.
Yeah, that's so good. Anyway.
Right, back to Barry. Barry Fry's walked into the Hereward FM. He's whistling "If I Only Had a Brain." He reached the reception desk. He took off his trademark hat and shouted, "Somebody order a fryer."
Oh, yes.
What a ridiculous man. Love the podcast, John Paul Stevenson.
That is so good. 100% believe it.
Have you heard my favourite ever Barry Fry story? Have you heard the one about him trying to break a gypsy curse that had been placed on Birmingham City?
Yeah. Have you heard that?
No. I mean, it's been doing the rounds for a few years. So basically, there's a sort of story about Birmingham City, a curse being placed on Birmingham City ground because they evicted some gypsies, sort of turn of the century. And ever since then, they were doomed to sort of bad luck and results and all this. And then Barry Fry one day consulted like some local gypsies about how to break it. And they said, on when the clock strikes midnight, you have to urinate on all four corners of the pitch, basically. And I think they were in a bad run of form at the time. So Barry Fry thought, fuck it, like, you know, what's there to lose? And basically went out on the pitch and pissed on all four corners. But my favourite detail is I think they lost to Wolves the next day.
Players kept complaining about the smell of piss. Yeah, couldn't focus.
You don't want to head one of those corners, Claire.
They conceded from a corner.
If you've got any more emails or any anecdotes about meeting Barry Fry, you know how to get in touch. It is hello@quicklykevin.com.
Okay, it's time for Do I Remember This Right?
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 Do I remember this right? Right, that's right.
All right, now last week we discussed the fact that Mark Hughes was good at volleys and the specialisms we used to have in the 90s of certain players. So we had this email from Ben Livesley. He says, on the subject of Mark Hughes' specialist volleys, I remember an incident where he hit one so well it went in and rebounded off the advertising hoardings. This was due to the Dells' famously narrow nets. Nice work from the officiating team that day. Who needs VAR? Yeah, these guys definitely do. So, and then he sent the link. I think he was saying, "Do you remember this?" And we watched the clip back. It's an astounding clip.
Yeah, so the incredible ball comes over from a corner. Hughes obviously is there on the volley.
Yeah.
He's lurking on the outside of the box where the volleys happen. And he volleys it, and it goes in. To the naked eye, you can't really see what's happening, I'd say.
Yeah, but it
does. It flies through a group of players, bounces out.
Goes in the goal, and then hits the advertising board, comes back out, and then Leeds clear it for a throw.
The most astonishing bit?
No one reacts.
No one complains. No one appeals.
Well, it's such a muted appeal.
Yeah.
And they give up so quickly.
Yeah, they give up.
You've just scored a goal. Like, I can't believe that you would go, oh, whatever, he's not going to give it. This is a First Division or Premier League match, like a First Division game. You remember that thing that ever happened to you, like when you would play football on Saturday or Sunday and the nets hadn't been wired properly?
Yeah.
So sometimes, like, someone could shoot, but it would go into the goal and through the net again.
And it looked like
you'd gone wide and you'd be livid at the referee. Yeah. Sunday league level, that's fine. This is
you wouldn't think it would be allowed that the hoardings would be able to bounce your ball back out.
How has that not happening all the time at the Dell in the 90s?
Well, I'll tell you why. Because no one volleys it like Mark Hughes.
Have you heard of the Mandela effect? So when people are interviewed, they say that they remember Nelson Mandela dying in prison in the 80s.
And he didn't die in prison.
The world.
But are you mad? No one remembers that, do they?
Well, apparently when people are surveyed. But the world kind of collectively forgot that he died in the 80s.
That's not a thing.
But he was the leader of South Africa for a decade.
Yeah, but the Mandela effect is like a collective loss of consciousness. And I'm suggesting that's what happened at the Dell.
Tenuous.
There we go. And finally, we've had some feedback relating to Steve Bruce's literary career. Mike Zonin 2000 on Twitter has dug out an ancient interview Steve Bruce did around 94, appears to be in Match magazine, in which he is asked for his favourite film.
Yes, please.
The answer he gives is The Fugitive. Now, many listeners will know that we believe the first book in Steve Bruce trilogy seems to nick the plot of The Fugitive.
It doesn't seem to. It definitely nicks the plot to The Fugitive. Minus the one-armed man, it steals a plot wholesale.
Also, when did The Fugitive come out?
1993.
I love that it's already Steve Bruce's favourite film. Well,
yeah, it's interesting.
As we know by the second book, No Time for the Past. Steve Bruce.
But do you know what? It's like when they used to do those polls in the 90s and the best song ever was Angels. Yeah. You're like, it only just came out. See if it stands the test of time.
Well, didn't Steve Bruce write these books around 1998, 99? So he's kept The Fugitive close to his heart for around five years.
Or maybe he's waited until The Fugitive. The Fugitive was a huge film at the time that actually hasn't really stood the test of time.
Yeah.
No one ever mentions The Fugitive now. Maybe Steve Bruce waited for it to blow over.
Well, what was he waiting for? He was waiting for the Mandela effect to inform public consciousness and everyone forget the plot to The Fugitive.
But actually, The Fugitive is like the inverse of Steve Bruce's books, because they came out, people hated them, and now they're probably the greatest thing ever written.
I'm delighted to hear Steve Bruce's favourite film. If any of you do have any of the other Match magazines where people reviewed their favourite films or any of their favourite things, Nigel Martin's favourite drinks was still it was a huge hit, as was Daniel Dicchio's DJ career. So if you've got anything with them, email in hello@quicklykevin.com. Enough of that. Let's move on with this week's interview. Friend of the show, the voice and face of Welsh football, Ellis James, discusses Welsh club football's most tumultuous decade. Don't worry, it's better than the subject makes it sound.
So Swansea came to Anfield with high hopes after that 0-0 draw. They started well, but the game simply turned into a rout. In fact, it's their worst defeat ever.
Our guest today is the voice and sometimes face of Welsh football, a man so synonymous with the Welsh game. He has his own podcast based on that niche world. A man who last time we met him was purely just a fan of Gareth Bale, has since met him and started a podcast with Ewan Roberts.
I'm Danny Gavadon. in a WhatsApp group with Ewan Roberts and Danny Gavadon. Every time I get a text from one of them, I get a little buzz. Because I think...
You need to put it on silent.
Yeah. I think... I used to pay to watch you.
It's funny when like ex-players that you used to idolise, but they cross the line into that, they do a bit of banter with you. I saw Steve Lomas at the weekend and I was wearing a smart suit, and the last time he saw me I wasn't. He went, oh, you've smartened up. And I thought, this is it, I'm essentially in the dressing room.
This is what they talk about missing.
We're having banter.
Chris, you are looking at a man who once had a late lunch with Kevin Ratcliffe.
Wonder who... Which WhatsApp chats Danny Gabardon's in?
This gets quite a lot of attention in the press in Wales. The Welsh players have a very active WhatsApp group, the squad.
Mm.
And I said, so are you still in it? Because when the WhatsApp group started, he was still playing. He said, no, once you announce your retirement, you're out of the group.
Oh.
Yeah, and I think what happens is they start new ones. So so he played in the first... few qualifiers, I think, for Euro 2016. But then when the tournament itself started, he'd announced his retirement from international football. They started a new WhatsApp group. He's not in that.
I remember it was in the paper that Cristiano Ronaldo had fallen out of the Real Madrid squad, but then apologised via WhatsApp on their WhatsApp.
Yeah, I tell you, that happened with Neymar and Edison Cavani as well. They had an argument, and apparently people knew they'd had an argument because they unfollowed each other on Instagram.
Oh, God. It's like sanctions.
Yeah, that's what Theresa May's going to do with Putin. It's not going to be topical by the time we go out. But just so you know, at the time of recording, that is absolutely razor sharp satire.
Yeah.
So, last time you brought us clips of managers going mad.
Yes.
This time, what have you got a clip for us?
I've got a clip. I've got two clips if you want them.
Yeah, why not?
This is Ian Wright, and he's talking about a school teacher who played a big part in his development as a footballer, because he came to football quite late, didn't he, Ian Wright? So he wasn't at a club at the age of 8 like modern players are. So this school teacher was very, very influential for him.
If this is the clip I think, I'm quite emotionally fragile this week because I'm quite tired. Is it going to send me...
Well, it is because he, for some reason, thought that this teacher had died and then he's doing a programme about his life and they're interviewing him at Highbury and he's talking about this teacher and he's quite emotional as it is and they surprise him. And he just turns up, and Wright hasn't seen this guy for, you know, 25 years or something, and also thinks he's
died.
Yeah.
Have you seen it, Michael?
No. I mean, I was, it absolutely
destroyed.
It's
one of the greatest clips I've ever seen. I wouldn't describe it as a hoot.
No, it's pretty emotional for all concerned.
Ian's still the highest scoring striker ever to play for Arsenal, and he owes a lot to the man who first taught him to kick a ball, his old school teacher, Sid Pigden.
As I haven't seen him for... what, 23, 24 years, and so he would now be expecting me to be 6 feet under, I would think. I don't actually think, he probably won't recognise me because he won't believe it's me. Hello, Ian. Long time no see.
Mr. Pigden. You're alive.
I'm alive, he says. How are you doing?
I can't believe it. Someone said you was dead.
As you see, I'm very passionate and I'm so glad you've done so well with yourself.
Oh, now, Ellis.
Now, obviously, this is a light-hearted podcast.
So should we talk about Ian Wright's clothes?
And I, and I have misjudged the mood and the tone.
I think it's really... It's, what did you think, Michael, having never seen it before?
Well, I never seen it before, and I also, too, have had a busy week. I'm very tired, and I genuinely am a difficult man to make cry, but I very, very nearly went then.
It's amazing. I've never seen Ian Wright look like that.
The thing I love about him...
That was Mr. Pinkton.
The thing I love about it is the way he calls him Mr. Pinkton.
Well, when he takes his hat off
and he takes
in a display of respect instantly.
Also, just to note that that is... We've described Ian Wright's hats like this before, but he's still wearing one. He's wearing the hat previously seen on Tinker from Love Shop.
Or the Artful Dodger. And that is Artful Dodger as in the Dickens Artful Dodger.
Not the Gary Jones.
My favourite thing about that clip is Ian Wright's face. If you just concentrate on his face, when the realisation hits him that he's staring at this kind of role model that he thought was dead. It's an amazing clip.
It is worth watching because as well... He's in the sort of the row of seats above Ian Wright. And then when Ian Wright goes to hug him, it's actually quite awkward. He's round his waist and he's crying and he's got his head in Mr. Picton's stomach. Mr. Picton is a man in his 60s, I'd imagine.
Mr. Picton.
He never expected Wright to burst
into
tears.
Mr. Picton hugs Ian Wright like a man who has never hugged another man.
Yeah. Do you know what? I was taken to Wales games by my geography teacher, because my dad doesn't like football, he's a rugby man. And I bumped into my old geography teacher at the Euros, and I was very, very drunk. I told him that he changed my life, and he responded in a way that all 65-year-old geography teachers would. He went, thanks.
When we met Ian Wright, Ellis. Yeah. I'm not sure, have I told this on here before, what Ian Wright said to me? So we filmed a thing with Ian Wright.
I tell this story on average twice a week. I love it, so do carry on.
No, feel free.
It's just, you went to shake his hand and he went, was it for a fist bump or a high five? But it all went a bit wrong. And Ian Wright said, Josh, you never blank a brother. As an opening gambit, absolutely loved that. Had you met him before?
Yeah, about years ago. Years ago, I'd done a radio thing which he'd been on. He's a lovely bloke. He's such a nice bloke. More clip?
If you want to lighten the tone.
Yeah.
The way I consumed football in the 90s was, it was HTV as it was then, but ITV Wales, I suppose it would be now, a programme called Soccer Sunday, which was a roundup of the Welsh clubs playing the Football League. So it was Wrexham, Cardiff City and Swansea City. And... it was hated by a lot of Swansea fans because he was seen to have a pro-Cardiff, anti-Swansea bias. I don't know if there's...
They have that, the West Country the one that all the Plymouth fans thought that was the case.
That there was a, what, an Exeter?
Pro-Exeter bias.
Yeah, this was a big deal for Swansea fans.
That would make more sense, the pro-Cardiff bias, because it's the capital and the...
Yeah.
The pro-Exeter bias really...
It's a slap in the face.
And the media's based in Cardiff. And, and they used to call the BBC... It was on ITV, but it was called the Bluebird Broadcasting Corporation and all that kind of stuff. And then I never really saw this. I think because I was too young and I just would watch anything. So I didn't really watch it with a critical faculty in mind. But Johnny Owen, who made I Believe in Miracles, the Nottingham Forest film, and who made Don't Take Me Home, the film about Wales at the Euros, he was the final presenter. And he ends his tenure in an amazing way. But I'm going to play the first bit of the clip just because... When you think of opening titles music for 90s football TV shows, you won't get very much better than this.
This was used elsewhere.
This has been used elsewhere.
Now, I watch a lot of Soccer Sunday clips researching this. I forgot how badly made it is. Now, that's Hugh Johns, and he did the ITV commentary when England won the 66 World Cup. So, obviously, Kenneth Wilson-Holmes says they think it's all over it is now. His version is absolutely rubbish. And someone once found it and wrote it for me on a birthday card. And I can't remember verbatim what it is, but it's something like, Hurst is in plenty of space... And he scored. England are world champion. And and he just completely misses an opportunity to be iconic. But the thing with Hugh Johns is the whole programme wasn't very good. And we won the 1994 Autoglass Trophy. We beat Huddersfield in the on penalties. And it's Hugh Johns commentating with Terry Orath doing co-coms. And there's a penalty, a Swans penalty. I can't remember who it is. But he goes, oh dear, it's hit the stanchion. Oh, Swansea 1-0 down. And Terry Orath goes, no, it went in. It just bounced back out and goes, oh, did it?
That's partridge.
He goes, okay. I thought it hit the stanchion and, oh, right, okay. Well, Swansea are 1-0 up, is it? And the ball is in Huddersfield's court. And it's just a bit rubbish. But the thing with Johnny Owen was he was the presenter and everyone knew he was a Cardiff City fan. But a lot of Swansea fans felt aggrieved that there was this pro-Cardiff anti-Swansea bias. So I'll try and find his parting shot.
Actually, I have to say it's certainly improved my acting skills presenting Soccer Sunday. Smiling when my beloved Cardiff City lose and keeping that smile when Swansea City win.
Now, that caused an absolute ruckus. Like, people were furious. Oh, he's actually said it! It's blatant! It's blatant! They're even the presenters are saying it now! We've been saying this all along for years!
But it doesn't matter, because they're still showing the games.
Yeah, there's this possibly apocryphal moment where I don't know if this even happened or if it's just something that's been concocted and gets recycled on internet forums a lot, where apparently one of the presenters went, and it's been a dreadful week for Welsh football as Cardiff City lose and Wrexham and Swansea win.
That's
surely not.
Right, let's start.
Yeah,
because we haven't started. No. Unbelievably. With the question we've never asked this to a guest that isn't a footballer before. We're going to start by asking a footballer to name every sponsor they've had.
Oh, right.
I'd like you to name every Swansea sponsor of the 90s.
DP Sports.
Yes, do you know what DP stands for?
No, but I wore a Swansea City DP Sports shirt on Josh, the sitcom, and the producer had to check for clearance, and I do know that they went bankrupt in 1991.
So that's 1989 to 91, 91 to 92.
It's diversified products for those playing along at home.
The Evening Post. That was a big
one. Yeah, that was 96, 97.
Gulf Oil.
Yeah, 93, 96.
Which I think is quite a big sponsor for...
Yeah! Isn't that Saddam Hussein?
I think that's quite a big coup. Bearing in mind that...
That's what Tony Blair wanted over there. Yeah. That's a big coup. Why are Gulf Oil decided... What league are you even in? Like, you're in a bottom league.
Yeah. Oh, hang on. Silver Shield.
Yes, 97-99.
We were owned by Silver Shield.
What were they?
Because it was a Coventry-based auto windscreens company, who then became a company known as Ninth Floor. Our chairman was a guy called Doug Sharp, who was a local businessman, and he'd saved the club, but he was always trying to sell, because what was happening was that he got a lot of stick, basically, for not being a multimillionaire, because at the time, the 90s, it was the era of the rich celebrity fan, Jack Walker being the most famous example. Who was the one at Newcastle? Jack?
Sir John Hall.
Sir John Hall. And we wanted Doug Sharp to be that, but I think he was a builder or something. He just, he'd lent the club $300,000 to, because we were wound up in 85. Mm. So the club were in serious financial trouble.
The other two you've missed, M&P Bikes.
Is he on the fall from grace? A bike shop.
An Action.
Oh, Action, of course.
What was Action?
Also, 91, 92, no sponsor.
Yeah, but it makes the kit look quite iconic, I think.
Like you were Barcelona.
Like we were Barcelona.
No, just that you couldn't secure a deal.
Yeah, even though it was that.
So, Swansea now have got a kind of lovely ground, seemingly going to be a Premier League team at the time of this is broadcast.
Well,
what's the state of Swansea City in the 90s?
It's quite an interesting decade. If I can give you a potted history of the club, we were, for about 40 years, quite a solid Division 2 team, as in old, second tier Division 2, which I think when you look at the size of the city and the catchment area of the club and the fact that rugby union is big as well, that probably suits us, I think. And then we had to apply for re-election to the Football League in 75. And then John Toshack became our player manager and we went 4-3-2-1 in 4 years. Then we came sixth in the First Division, having been leaders at Easter. So it looked like we were going to win it. So we were top from the very first game. We beat Leeds 5-1 in the opening day of the season. So we're top until Easter. Then we lost five out of the last six and came sixth, which was the lowest we'd been all season. And the thing is, the early 80s, Ipswich had won the UEFA Cup, Forest had won the European Cup. It was kind of something that could happen in those days.
So what you're saying is you'd probably have won the European Cup as well.
Well, we went 4-3-2-1, 1-2-3-4. So we were in all four divisions twice in 8 years. So we applied for
when you were top at Easter, you then went into free fall and were relegated the following season.
Wow. So 75 applied for re-election to the Football League, which is quite a close run thing, because we're so far west. I imagine Plymouth will have this problem. Clubs didn't actually want to play us. And also in the early 70s, we had quite a good side, so you might get 20,000 or 22 or 23,000 at the Vetch, and then 2 years later there's 1,500 there. So the thing with going 4-3-2-1 in 4 years and then having a really good season, the kind of foundations were built on sand, really. So it's all sellouts for a season, and then the club are dreadful, and then it's down to 3,000 again, and then the club got wound up on Boxing Day, I think, or Christmas Eve 1985, and then in the 90s we were just a low division team, so we were just dreadful. It was a car crash.
What was the Vetch like?
The Vetch was,
because I've walked past it, and it looked awful.
I loved it. But
how bad were the facilities?
Routinely voted the worst toilets in the Football League.
So how bad were they?
It was a trough. I once met a bloke who'd had a shit at the Vetch, and I shook him by the hand.
This is a favourite subject of mine. I never had a poo at Upton Park last game ever there. Yeah. And like,
no, it's a blessed relief for the Olympic Stadium. Yeah. The toilets are nice on the ground.
Do you know what? The thing with the...
There's still a toilet at Argyle. So Argyle have got three sides of identical new ground, as you imagine it, and then one, the old grandstand. The toilets, which are just a wall, literally, you know, you walk in, there's a wall, and then there's... What would it be? Just a drain, I suppose.
Yeah.
And it just... It's been there 100 years being pissed on.
Yeah.
100 years.
Imagine that, being pissed on for 100 years.
Do you know how I would sum up the Vetch? All our most vocal fans used to stand on the north bank, which ran along the side of the pitch. And it was a very, very big stand, very big terrace at one point. But then it was condemned, the final two-thirds were condemned by the council. So they just built... They just built a plywood wall about a third of the way up because there were holes in the floor, and the plywood wall was sponsored by Monster Munch.
Which flavour?
It was the purple. That's
pickled onion.
Pickled onion, isn't it? So I never got to stand on the North Bank in all its glory, because that happened in the late 80s.
So what
were
the pit? Was it like proper Monster Munch kind of mural?
It was a very...
Like that Arsenal mural, but with monsters.
Yeah, so it was a very big terrace that held about 20,000 at one point. So then they built this wall a third of the way up, this plywood wall that was sponsored by Monster Munch. And people used to chuck their burgers over the wall.
Yeah.
Oh, no. And then in the final game we played at the match against Shrewsbury, some people started pulling the wall down. I went and had a look and stood at the back. And it was quite interesting because there were these huge gaping holes, and it would have cost the club £250,000 to mend. So obviously it wasn't financially viable. But there were these big holes. You think, how did they let it get into this state in the first place? But the thing I really liked was there was a lot of graffiti from the early 80s. It was a kind of a time capsule, because people, they built the Monster Munch wall and had just left it. So there was all like Alan
There was
Curtis.
One guy still in there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Come on, Sydney!
Living on the pies.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And then you had the away end, which I don't remember this, but it had been a double decker that was made of wood. So it was a twin tier stand. And then the top of it was condemned by the council. So what they did was they just removed the top. So it was
replaced it with a Monster Munch roof.
No, but what happened if you stood on the away end, you'd look up and there'd be stairwells leading to nowhere. And just these footwells go into a stand that no longer existed.
Doesn't exist.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. So the who played
the away end
bench.
At Home Park in the '90s was literally the standing with no roof, nothing. So just it's just a triangle
bank.
Of concrete.
Yeah, that's what it was in Indian Park.
I remember, like, if it was particularly rainy, they'd just have to take the people out and bring them in with the Plymouth fans.
Yes.
Because it was just maybe like Tuesday night in November, and it'd just be sheets of rain. Yeah. 60 Cambridge fans. Right.
Yeah. We played.
Sometimes count the away, because it was like.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You can't just sit and you count the away fans.
Yeah, I remember that. 53 Bournemouth. Yeah.
And I've we've got to thank all of the 49 Exeter City fans who've turned up today. Give them a round of applause.
But yes, so then we had the old East Stand, which had bankrupted the club in the early 80s. And it was a very modern stand. It was a bit like how the old Trafford looked, in that it was meant to curve all the way around and replace the centre stand, which was the oldest stand in the Football League. Before that had been built, it was just an empty bank that was, and it was old railway sleepers, so it was actually very slippery to stand on, no roof. It was my dad's summer job to knock the railway sleepers back in, actually, but just the lack of facilities was incredible.
And did that kind of set the tone for the club in the 90s? Because you were just, in my mind, growing up in the 90s, Swansea were worse than Plymouth. They were like a proper bottom division team.
Do you know what? In 1990, we drew 0-0 with Liverpool, who were the team, league champions at the time, the sort of Barnes, Aldridge, Beardsley sort of Liverpool team. We drew 0-0 with them at the Vetch in the FA Cup, and then we lost 8-0 at Anfield. But it's worth it. It's on YouTube. There's a Swansea pitch invader, and he gets on, and initially he's booed by the fans, and he does such a good job of evading the stewards. Eventually, he turns it around, so the Anfield crowd greet him with warm applause, and then he scores. He knocks the ball past Bruce Robles. Absolutely hilarious.
To be fair, Bruce Robles was getting a grand to let it in.
Yeah. And then we won the Welsh Cup, and we played Monaco.
You won the Welsh Cup in 1991.
Which got you into Europe, you see.
Do you know how many people watched you beat Wrexham in the final? 5,000.
Oh, was it at the... That was at the National Stadium, wasn't it? That was at the old Cardiff Arms Park, yeah.
So, did anyone care about the Welsh Cup?
Well, they did by the final, because it got you into Europe. Newport County, for instance, got to the European Cup Winners' Cup quarter-finals, believe it or not. Bangor City beat Napoli. Cardiff beat Real Madrid. We got stuffed by Monaco 8-0 when Arsene Wenger was manager. Prince Rainier of Monaco went to the game and sat in what was basically our director's box, which was, I mean, it didn't even have a padded, you got a tray of sandwiches. Prince Rainier, I was thinking of the famous people who sat in that box. Prince Rainier of Monaco, Yuri Geller and Leslie Ash. the big three.
Not together.
No.
One episode of Men Behaving Badly, that would have been.
Rogues gallery.
Could I just... I was looking into this. So you won the Welsh Cup in 1991. You lost in the final in 1990. Do you know who beat you in the final of the Welsh Cup?
Oh, this would have been one of the... Was it one of the border teams?
Hereford. They're in England. Hereford.
Yeah, we allowed teams like Kidderminster Harriers and I think Shrewsbury probably and...
Just to compete because it was near Wales.
Well, the thing is...
Does the Welsh Cup still exist?
The Welsh Cup, it's the third oldest cup in the world, the Welsh Cup. But now we're not allowed to enter it because we play in the English pyramid. But so Colin, Bay and Wrexham and Cardiff and Swansea and Newport aren't allowed to play in the Welsh Cup anymore.
I wanted to talk about the Football League of Wales because in my... I before I researched this interview, I was under the impression that the Football League of Wales had been around for hundreds of years. But actually, it was created in 91 on the basis that Alan Evans, who was like head of the Football Association of Wales... had a conspiracy theory that they were going to try and merge all the kind of Great Britain Football Associations.
That, really? That is actually, I mean, that's not really a conspiracy theory.
Because, here we go.
The South American
The South American nations and the African nations think that we're basically cheating and that we're taking up potential four places at the World Cup. We're really, so like Team GB, the Welsh and Scottish and Northern Irish ones were dead against it. Because it essentially weakens the argument that we are our own country with our own footballing traditions, which is why Wales doing so well at the Euros and Gareth Bale being so marketable and Ryan Giggs being our manager is actually hugely important because...
Do you think...
Ecuador don't think that we should have a place at the World Cup. It's quite difficult to imagine now because it looks like Cardiff are going to be in the Premier League and the Swans are in the Premier League. In the 90s, we were rubbish. Cardiff will often make the argument, Cardiff fans often make the argument that they're this sleeping giant and that they're this dormant, massive club with this huge potential support in the valleys and they'll take the mickey out of our attendances. I mean, in the 90s, which is when I grew up, Cardiff City's chairman was a guy called Rick Wright who owned the fairground at Barry Island. It was pretty small time for all concerned. Like, let's not beat around the bush here. Like, I'm well aware that there was 50,000 at Ninian Park when they beat Real Madrid and all that kind of stuff. But in the 90s, when I was going, it was like 3,500 in Ninian Park and it was 3,500 at the Vetch.
The rivalry's one of the most insane in the UK, isn't it? In the 90s, you weren't allowed away fans.
No, we're the first bubble game in Britain. Because
so how does that work?
When we played Cardiff in the FA Cup at the Vetch in 1991... The mayor of Swansea described it as the worst violence the city had seen since the Blitz. Bearing in mind that they Coventry-ed Swansea, the city centre was built in the 60s because they absolutely, the gym has flattened it. To bring the Blitz into it, it was absolute bedlam. But we haven't played them for about 15 years, between 65 and 80, certainly not in the league. We might play them in Welsh Cup, but... By the 90s, we played them quite a lot, and it was a very, very nasty rivalry. And a bubble game, it means that, for instance, right, the last time we played Cardiff in the Premier League, I went with my mate, who I've been going to the Swans with for years, and he lives about 100 yards from the Cardiff City Stadium. But because he's a Swansea fan, he had to drive back to Swansea, get the bus to Cardiff, where he's given his ticket on the bus, so you're not allowed to have your ticket beforehand. You're in the ground 2 hours before the game starts. And then at the end, even though he could see his house, he was driven back to Swansea on the bus and then he had to drive back to Cardiff. Because it was just a very, very volatile fixture. It's like, have you ever seen a game behind closed doors? They might do that to West Ham.
Yeah, fingers crossed.
But it's such an odd thing to... I think... Did Rangers play Milan behind closed doors? I remember watching footage of that.
Camp. Barcelona played a game recently, like on Tuesday, kind of two in the afternoon.
It was during the Catalan riots.
The footage is insane. Because you can hear every kick of the ball.
And you can hear all the players shouting
as
well.
It's really disconcerting.
One of my favourite clips of the modern era is there's someone, you can hear all the players talking on the pitch and someone has put subtitles up and you can hear them, like the complaints of the referee and Luis Suarez crying when he like gets tackled.
In the 90s where Scotland played, I want to say Estonia, and didn't turn up for some reason, like dispute over bonuses or whatever it would be, and then Scotland had to kick off.
This is
they won 3-0.
Yeah,
and I remember seeing Ali McCoist on They Think It's All Over. I don't know why this has stuck with me, And he said, we won 3-0 and I'm claiming two of them. And he said, one was a deflection, but I'm claiming.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought, that's a great line.
Yeah.
I don't know if he's got writers.
Scotland taking the field for their World Cup qualifying game against Estonia in Tallinn today, despite the complete absence of their opponents. Estonia refusing to turn up for a match which had been brought forward from an evening to an afternoon kickoff because the floodlights were considered inadequate. 800 Scottish fans had arrived for the new kickoff in the Cadriog Stadium, singing "We only play in the daylight." The referee, Miroslav Radoman of Yugoslavia, shook hands with Scotland's captain, John Collins of Monaco, and all the match formalities were duly observed. The whistle blew to start the game and then blew again to signal its end. FIFA will now rule if Scotland are to be awarded the match 3-0 and if the Estonians are to be fined for their absence.
Best game of the 90s for Welsh football, I would say, was Wrexham beating Arsenal.
Do you know what? It would be the Swans beat West Ham in January 99 in the FA Cup, and I think we don't get the credit we deserve because whenever they talk about
a strange way to answer Wrexham,
but whenever they talk about the great giant,
that media bias you were banging on.
Whenever they talk about media giant, the big giant killings, it's always Colchester beating Leeds, Hereford beating Newcastle, and then Wrexham Arsenal. But we were in the bottom division 99.
Yeah. Even Wrexham had finished bottom.
Yes.
Arsenal had finished top.
Yeah.
And then Mickey Thomas scored the equaliser at the age of... Oh, scored the winner. No, the equaliser.
Yeah, it was Steve Watkin.
Age of 38.
Yeah, and he's got a horrendously stringy ponytail.
Yeah.
If you look back at the footage, his hair is awful.
So here's some research on Mickey Thomas. He went to prison the following year.
Yeah,
Do you know why?
He was basically photocopying tenors, wasn't he? And selling them to the youth team, and they were all 16, going, "Wow, this guy photocopies his own money." He got stabbed in the arse with a screwdriver by his wife.
By his brother-in-law for shagging the brother-in-law's.
Oh God! And it was in a car, wasn't it?
Yeah, he was shagging in a car. He got stabbed in the arse with a screwdriver.
But in the act,
from what I understood, it was mid-act. And he had his trousers down and he got stabbed in his bum cheek with a screwdriver.
Oh.
Now, the thing with Mickey Thomas, he played for Man United. Like, he was a good player. You kind of forget all of that.
Yeah.
Because I imagine he has an autobiography. And
I wonder if Ryan Giggs had read it.
But it must be a cracking read. But yeah, that
Wrexham... He sells photocopies of it for half price.
So, Ellis, do you want to make the case for Swansea beating West Ham for being the biggest giant killing from a Welsh lens of the
night? I just think that, you know, in terms of, it was a four division gap, we beat you in the replay.
Yeah.
We drew one all at Upton Park, and we then beat you at the Vetch.
Yeah.
It's part of the sort of Cyril the Swans glory period. Now, I've actually had to write some of this down because... So, Cyril the Swan first appeared by abseiling into the Vetch in the summer of 1998.
Cyril Swan's a mascot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's a big swan, right?
He is a big swan.
Can I ask, he's got a long neck.
He's got a very long neck.
Can I ask, how high up the neck is the head of the human?
Well.
How much, like, extra stuff?
We'll try and work this out, because he kept getting fined. He got into an altercation.
By the club?
Yeah, well, the Welsh FA. He comes at, right, get this, right? He comes under the jurisdiction of the Welsh FA, but in the late 90s, Cyril, it's a different bloke doing Cyril now. He's been sanitised by the Premier League. But in the late 90s, it was like a groundsman or something. And the guy just could not behave. So he kept getting fined. He got fined £1,000 for running on the pitch to celebrate a goal. He got fined by the FAW, Association of Wales, who then, because mascots were new,
he didn't have to watch from the stands.
No. No.
Arsene Wenger.
But they did have to consult the NFL when they wrote guidelines to mascot behaviour, and they consulted the NFL because they were like, this is completely new, but this guy, he keeps doing this stuff. He got into an altercation with Bruce Rioch when he played Norwich. Bruce Rioch ended up basically fighting with a 9-foot bird.
What did did he do? Was he like?
They were. I think he got fined. He got fined for kicking the ball against one of the players. We played Millwall in the cup, I think it was, and he kicked the ball against the players.
Why didn't they just replace the guy in the Swan?
Well, to be honest, I thought this, but it. He brought the club a lot of publicity.
I also think if you...
He was more famous than the club.
If you take that out of his game, you lose what makes him so good.
Yes. I remembered all this stuff, so I Googled Cyril the Swan. There is not a single article about Cyril the Swan that doesn't use the word notoriety. Now he ripped the head off Millwall's mascot, Zampa the Lion, and drop-kicked the head into the crowd. And when he was asked what he'd said to Zampa the Lion, he replied, "I said you don't fuck with the swans." he was voted Personality of the Year by the Swansea by the South Wales Evening Post, which bizarrely drew criticism from Mark Lawrenson. Mark Lawrenson said, "How can you give a swan Personality of the Year?" Yes, we got into an altercation with Bruce Rioch. He would get on the pitch a lot.
Would he celebrate goals?
Oh yeah, big time. And he was quite a provocative character. There was a lot of him going up to the away end and sort of doing that with his big wings.
Because I was going to ask about the arms. So are the arms in wings? Are they
I loved him. What I liked about Cyril the Swan, they don't do this anymore. In those days, when the mascots came on, you would take a penalty in the actual goal. Whereas nowadays they bring on like a little goal, which I think is really boring, disappointing. Yeah. But he would try and save penalties from 6 and 7 year olds using his big wings. I'd love to meet this guy, but this I wasn't there for this. But apparently, in the late 90s, it was 5 or 6 mascots who were, you know, children, and then one bloke who was 35, who's called Jason for Talbot, but he'd paid the money and he got to take a penalty. We almost went down in.
Contractually, we can't do anything.
Yeah,
we just got us over a barrel. There's just some other things that I just need to fact check. So Terry Yorath is Swansea and Wales manager at the same time twice.
Yes.
So was he one of the times that you had 4 managers in a year at Swansea?
We had 5 managers in 95-96, and
first team to ever do it, right?
Yeah, in the top 10 of... You know they do those top 10 shortest reigns of managers in British football?
Yeah.
We've got 2 entries in the top 10. Both from the 90s. Kevin Cullis, who was there for a week.
Yeah.
And Mickey Adams, who was there for 13 days. We'll never beat Leroy Rosinia's record, which is 600 seconds as manager of Torquay United.
How did that happen?
I don't know, but when you're measuring managerial reigns in seconds... 10 minutes. He was manager of the club for 10 minutes.
I've got a quote about Cullis. This was before his second and final game. Oh, Christian Edwards said, "It was like a pantomime. Before the game, he pulled me and Roger Freestone."
Oh, Roger Freestone, yeah.
"To one side and started talking about new contracts, 4-year deal, and it was Monopoly money, fantasy stuff. I was 20 years of age, earning 125 a week, and living with my mum and dad. And he was on about 3 or 4 grand on a new Mercedes."
The thing with Kevin Cullis. Doug Sharp, who was our manager, who was our chairman at the time, had saved the club but didn't really have a huge amount of money. But the fans were very frustrated because we were a selling club. It would just look like we were going to create something and then he'd sell our best player.
Kevin Cullis, am I right, was youth team coach at Cradley Town in the West Midlands?
Yeah, and there was this amazing quote where he said, so Cradley Town, he was the youth team coach. So from memory... The youth team at Cradley were really good, but that is if your under 14s team is beating all comers, I don't think that qualifies you to manage in the Football League. In his press conference, he said whether it's Inter Milan or Cradley Town, football is still the same sport, and I thought he's factually correct, but I would say there's slightly more to it than that.
The other thing I found about him is that. You were losing 4-0. During the team talk, presumably at half-time, the players ejected him from the dressing room.
Yeah. It's, now, Kevin Cullis, my best friend at school is a big Cardiff City fan.
Yeah.
And my memory of Kevin Cullis is seen through the prism of the boy I used to sit next to who thought it was the funniest thing he'd ever heard. As an addendum, The chairman claimed that he resigned. He claimed that he never did. He claims that he was sacked and that the first he'd heard about it was when he called Swansea's club call.
Why is the manager calling club call?
Why did he do that?
Also, I can't believe that Swansea had a club call back then. I thought it was only like...
Everyone had a club call.
But also, such an expensive way to find out news from your own club. It was about 50p a minute or something. It was an absolute car crash.
As someone that knows about football but doesn't know, I've never worked within football, if you got hired by Swansea City on your first day of training, do you think you could maintain their respect for a full session? Like, what would be your plan?
I asked Iwan and Danny this, because obviously Ryan Giggs, as far as Welsh footballers go, there's very few to rival him. And they said he will get more of a grace period than someone who hasn't played the game. But if after a week they think he doesn't know what he's talking about or they don't buy into his system, he's then back to zero.
Have you seen that, Ryan? The footage of Ryan Giggs giving his last team talk?
Yes, it made me want to cry. Oh. All right, obviously, I'm on the league. It's very disappointing for fans. So let's go out there and give him something to shout about.
Give something for the fans.
Give some fans something to shout about. obviously, we're not winning the league. It's shit, actually. In conclusion, just try, because obviously we're at home. Got to give the fans some chats about. Best of luck. Come on, mate. And you're just thinking, it's half time. It's, I don't know, it's a playoff for the 2020 European Championships. And we're 1-0 down. Ryan, inspire them.
obviously, very important game now.
Yeah. England are already qualified.
Well, Alan Tate used to say Michael Laudrup was the best player at the club and he was 49. And the thing with Ryan Giggs is, Iwan Roberts made the point that in the very first session, if he says, right, I want you to do this, and he pings a 50-yard crossfield ball, you won't be able to stop yourself from going, oh, all right, well, he still got it. But if his ideas are bad, then all of that respect will disappear.
Well, you had a big player as your manager when you were in the lower leagues, Jan Molby.
Yeah.
A, how fat was he by this point?
He was big. I remember getting his autograph, and my main memory of Jan Molby was I was quite a small teenager, but he was huge.
He must have been so much better than everyone else at football.
Yeah, of course. I mean, not the most mobile. Let's not beat around the bush. But I got his autograph when he was manager of the Swans, and my memory of it was that he didn't look at the paper as he was signing it. And then I had to write Jan Molby next to it because his writing is so bad.
Did you look down? It was just a number.
Yeah, I thought there's no way I'll be able to pass this off as Jan Molby's autograph. I've still got it somewhere.
I love that his vision is so good that, you know, like a player who's always looking up. Molby's doing that with autographs.
Yeah, the no-look autograph.
The next autograph hunter.
This is going to sound ridiculous, but bear with me. Do you know what? Our record signing was a guy called Colin Irwin, who we bought in 81, I think, from Liverpool for £350,000. He was our record signing until 2008. 27 years. And when I was going in sort of the early 2000s, we were talking about this, because the club at the time didn't have a bank account. I remember going...
What do you mean he didn't have a bank account?
Because we'd been put into administration, so the club didn't have a bank account. And I remember going into the club shop... And everything was going through Hugh Jenkins, who was the chairman. It was all going through his building firm. So I went to the club shop to buy a mug or a scarf or something, and I used my card, and the till receipt was, you know, courtesy of Jenkins and Davis, Rufus, Morriston. Oh, my God, the club doesn't have a bank account. So all our players were loanees. Because the club was in such dire financial straits.
You did have... Well, I was going to say, speaking of big money, at the 1992 Football League Cup final at Wembley Stadium, there was a sprint contest.
Yeah.
And John Williams won it in a time of 11.49 seconds. I don't know if that's 100 metres. Beating, amongst others, F. Anacocca. He got a 10 grand first prize. Do you think he got allowed to keep the money?
Well, we were a club of freaks. So we had the fastest player in the Football League, John Williams. Yeah. We had Andy
John
Lev.
Merrick as well. That was
We had Andy Legg with the longest throw-in in the Football League. We had a guy called Walter Boyd, who got sent off, and this record will never be beaten. He came on as a sub, got involved in an altercation with someone as he was walking onto the pitch, got sent off for that, but it was before the referee had blown to restart the game. So he was sent off officially after 0 seconds.
So how did he get involved? How do you get involved in an altercation?
So he's come on as a sub. It's not even like he could have heated up in the tunnel.
No.
He's walked on.
He's walked on.
What was his excuse?
I don't know if someone had...
Were you there?
No, I was. It was an away game, I think. I don't know if someone had said something. But, yes.
Yeah, so, he was actually the guy that was in Cyril the Swan.
The thing with John Williams...
The flying postman.
The flying postman. He was very quick. But he was very good at running in straight lines. And his final product left a lot to be desired. And my memory of John Williams, when I picture him, is you've got the north bank where I used to stand, then you've got the away end, which is behind the goal, and then there's a gap. And you used to have, and that was houses, because I don't know if you've been to the Vetch, but it's right in the middle of town, surrounded by terraced houses. So those houses, which were between the away end and the north bank, people would stand on milk crates and watch the game for free. I mean, of course we were in financial trouble. The other thing, financial trial, I remember queuing for the at the turnstiles once, and suddenly there was a lot of fuss and there was this ripple of discontent, and someone said, oh my god, they're going to ask for NUS cards. They're going to ask for any, what's an NUS card? And I said, well, it's to show that you're a student, because it was like 11 quid for the North Bank, but it was £6 or £5 if you're a student. And this bloke went, oh shit, he said, I've been claiming I was a student since 1988. And no one ever asked. I thought, well, of course the club's on its ass. No one is even paying full price. But with John Williams, so he'd beaten his man with pace, and he was trying to cross the ball in, and he scuffed it, he sliced it to such an extent that it curled off, so it was between, it landed up in the gardens between the away end and the north bank. It's the kind of thing... You know those balls you buy on the beach that are 10 pence and are impossible to control? Yeah. It was like he was playing with one of those. So the ball slices off in a direction that defies physics. And we were dire at the time, and he was so angry at himself, he screamed, he had his head in his hands, and he started kicking the turf. And it was a display of emotion that showed that at least he cared. And the North Bank burst into a rendition of Super, Super John. I thought, we've got to ask for more than this from him. We have to set our sights higher. The guy is being paid for this. Come on.
Well, if you're in such financial dire straits, someone might have gone down the shop and thought, we can't buy one of those leather ones. Get that 10p one off.
So was he rubbish? He was limited.
Well, do you remember when he won the League Cup?
Yeah, race, because it was on.
Were you pleased?
Because it was on St. Greavesy.
Yeah.
Like, it made him momentarily famous. He ended up at Coventry, didn't he?
Yeah.
He played in that. I think he might have briefly played in the Premier League.
Yeah, he
actually
did, yeah.
And then he came back to us.
Did you watch that sprint?
I don't remember that. I remember it being on St. Greavesy mainly. And then you just being quite proud that you've got this sort of. You just take it where you can get it. Anything you can be proud of.
So we should finish with positives. You won the only thing you won apart from the Welsh FA Cup. So the only thing of note, the auto windscreen shield.
Yeah, the Autoglass Trophy.
Autoglass Trophy
in 1994. The thing with the Autoglass is obviously it's a day out in Wembley. There was a guy, I don't know his real name, but he used to take a big video camera, like an early 90s video camera, the type that you'd have in a primary school in the early 90s. And he would take it to games, mainly to film the trouble, and then he would show the hooliganism in pubs in town.
What? Like an alternative match of the day.
Obviously, everyone called him Spielberg.
So he'd be in the stand.
He'd be in the stand.
He'd be allowed to take his video camera.
Yeah.
And he'd not be filming the game, he'd be filming the trouble.
If there was any aggro, he'd be filming that. And then he would.
And then people would go to a pub to watch it.
Yeah, apparently. Obviously, I mean, I was a little kid, so it's slightly before my time. But it's interesting because it's the pre-mobile phone age, so everyone's so excited that there's a camera. So if you watch his videos, it's just people going, Spielberg, 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 hey, 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 hey. Now, I watched the Autoglass Trophy one. The standard of face painting in 1994, it looks like it's been done with house paint. And the thing with Spielberg, from what I understand, I'd have to have this confirmed by someone, South Wales Police found out that this was happening, and then they raided his house, and they used the videos he'd made to convict basically his friends who he'd been videoing, because obviously the evidence is all there for all to see.
So as a modern Swansea fan now, do you look back on the 90s and maybe smell the roses a little more now because you had that period?
I do, because I don't remember us being successful in the 70s and 80s. So in my mind, I probably started taking notice of football, I would imagine, in the early 90s. You know, we were bad. We were a bad team and a poorly supported team, because it's a football city, but it's, at the time, it was a Liverpool city and a Man United city. So like any club in the lower divisions, we could call up for a big game, the ground would sell out, and you think, oh great, there's 50,000 here today, this is brilliant. Or we took 20,000 to Wembley, but like, it's just a different planet.
It's like, it's a different club, isn't it?
Yeah, the lady who ran the club shop was a woman called Myra, and you think, you shouldn't know the staff by their first name. Like, if you go into the Man United superstore at Old Trafford, you're like, hey, it's Tony! We got taken over in the late 90s by a guy called Tony Petty, and he tried to destroy the club. He put most of our top players on the transfer market because he couldn't make ends meet, and I think he'd bought the club for a quid, and he basically got hounded out of town. So I think someone attacked him at the Vetch and all this sort of stuff, and there was a big march to try and get rid of him, and that's when the Swans Trust came in. So that's when the new club was reborn, really, with Tony Petty. But if you want to hear about the Tony Petty story, it's all in the film Jack to a King, which is sort of the modern history of Swansea Football Club. And the thing with Tony Petty, he was loath. Like, it wasn't safe for him to go in the city. So when the club was bought off him, it was bought off him for 20 grand in cash, which was kept in a Tesco carrier bag, and it was given to him at the Copthorne Hotel in Cardiff because he wouldn't go to Swansea. And the amazing thing is, because the club was on its arse, he wasn't based in Swansea, he was Australian. So whenever he turned up at the Vetch, he would call from Newport to say, I'm on my way. And club staff would go into the turnstiles and hide in the money because they didn't want him to have it. Like it was an absolute mess, right? But it was just so then we got rid of Tony Petty, and then the club was taken over by local directors and the fans' trust, and it was, everyone chipped in, and then 10 years later we're in the Premier League. But in terms of an experience, it's just such a roller coaster, because, you know, we were dire.
So if you could go back to January the 1st, 1991, and relive it, would you?
Do you know what? I missed the Vetch, and it was more fun. If we hadn't left the Vetch, we'd still be in the lower divisions, and I'm sure I'd be complaining that the club weren't showing enough ambition. But it's not the same, and I don't like sitting at football.
Would you still be playing your student fair?
Oh, absolutely. But it's just amazing that no one thought to check. And then one day someone went, I know there's a university in Swansea, but the club seems to be mainly supported by students.
A lot of postgrads doing their PhD.
Yeah.
Ellis James, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
That was Ellis James. Oh, so much fun listening to that. It's like relaxing in a nice, warm sofa.
Do you know what? We did it with Tom Parry and with Fordy as well, Matt Ford. You just want to complete the full 92 clubs of fans talking about their 90s. I'd say that Cyril the Swan has to go down as now my favourite non-Plymouth Argyle mascot after that.
Yeah.
Astonishing. If you have got a better club mascot, any 90s club mascot anecdotes, here's a do I remember this, right? I seem to remember Bristol City. Did they have the three little pigs, and why would they have had that? I remember them getting in a fight with a different mascot.
So are you asking us to cover your own question on our own feature?
Yeah. No, I'm asking the listeners. Right. This is going the other way now.
Okay.
If you're a Bristol City fan, or do I remember this? I'm sure, A, why were the three little pigs something to do with Bristol City? And B, didn't they get in a fight with someone?
Three on one, presumably.
Yeah.
A multi-person mascot team. Incredible.
I would love it if they were playing away at Wolves and they got into a fight with a big bad wolf.
If you want to get in touch, Jim Rosenthal will tell you how.
Get in touch with the show. Email hello@quicklykevin.com.
Follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Quickly Kevin, and sign up to the mailing list at quicklykevin.com.
Now, we've been asking for your reviews as haikus on iTunes. Remember, 5 stars will be looked on favourably. If we choose your haiku as our favourite of the week, you will win a strictly not that limited edition Quickly Kevin Graham Says Hitler's mug.
It's review haiku, 90s football review haiku. Review haiku.
Okay, firstly, this from Michael Wicks. Kevin Pilkington, Daniel De Cruz Carvalho, John Bezweatherick.
Oh yeah, he played for Argyle.
I think the middle one's got 8 syllables.
Well, okay. Well,
I mean, people are having an absolute nightmare with these.
I enjoyed that one just because of the Plymouth reference. I liked it.
And the second one is this by Colcon Rongles. It begins like this. Mitre Ultimax, dreaming of Lee Sharp's fan club, David Batty, hide!
Yes!
I mean, he's played to the crowd there.
Yeah, he absolutely knows what he's doing. That's
the winner, definitely.
So that's Colcon Rongles. If you want to leave an iTunes haiku review, you can do so by going on the iTunes website and not emailing us.
Or tweeting or Facebook messaging. They will be ignored no matter how good they are. We've had some great ones, but you're not winning a mug.
No mug. Not even a tea bag.
Now it is time for this week's quiz.
So here's how it works. Each week, Josh and Chris go head-to-head in a 90s football quiz to choose which song gets to play out the end of the show. Last week, Chris won and picked the theme tune to The Shoe People. But Josh is currently 3-2 up for the series.
So much to play for.
So this week, the quiz is a 90s football 6 degrees of separation.
Oh, yes, please.
Here's how it works. In front of you is a pot with various random names of 90s footballers. You must each pick one from the pot and then link those two players in as few moves as possible. The person who links those players in the fewest move is the winner. And to make things harder, the links must have happened in the 90s. So Josh's player, for example, if you've got Lee Dixon, and let's just say Chris had Graham Lassau, yeah. You have to link those two players with other players that they've played with until you can...
Oh, so you couldn't say they present on ESPN together?
No, it has to be teams that they played for in the 90s. Okay, so
brilliant
Josh...
Game. Really excited about this.
Pick your name from the hat, please.
What a fix. It's David Batty.
Well, Josh has picked David Batty. And Chris?
Efana Koku.
Oh, hello. I mean, all the names in there were related to the podcast. Okay, so you have 60 seconds to come up with your link. While you're working that out, for the listeners at home, here is a clip of those players in action.
One for Chapman to gamely chase. Steve Redmond back defending. Chapman will need support here. Batty! Oh, it's his first goal in 4 years for Leeds United.
Now a chance. No flag. Ball Fox. Ekoku to his left. Fox shoots. Ekoku follows up and gets his hat-trick.
Okay, that's your time up. Do you both have a link between the two players?
Yes, I've got one person that played with both of them.
Okay, that's impressive. Chris?
I've got a two or a one.
Okay.
But I'm going to go with the one.
Well, you need to.
Two won't help you, unless my one's wrong.
Okay, so, Josh, what is your link?
Warren Barton.
Yeah.
Because I think he would have played with Wimbledon with Efna Coke.
He would have played, yeah. And then
and
at Newcastle
with
David Batty. Yeah. Chris, what's your one?
I always got confused between John Scales and Warren Barton.
Oh, no.
I've done it then. But that's not my one.
Okay.
My one is Rule Fox. I think he played for Norwich.
I thought Rule Fox as well.
And I think
crossed
he
out Rule Fox.
And I think he played with Newcastle as well.
Okay, I'll have to check that one. I don't know that one off the top of my head.
He would have played with... Yeah, I think he's correct. Or would he have moved to Spurs?
Well, he played for Newcastle 94-95, so it's just a question of where David Batty was there. He may not have been.
He was not, no. He Batty didn't go till later.
He missed out by a year.
Oh, heartbreak. I'd crossed out the words Rule Fox.
I had gone Chris Sutton.
Oh, of course.
Would have played at Blackburn with... Batty and then Norwich with the Koku.
Of course. Oh.
Okay, so Josh is the winner and that puts him 4-2 up for the series.
Please.
Which song would you like to play out the show?
Young at Heart by the Bluebells.
Oh, lovely. Absolutely lovely.
Thank you very much for joining us this week. Next week we have Pat Nevin. If you would like to catch our live show, we've got tickets available for MacFest. You can go on the MacFest website and get the details of that. There's a few tickets left if you so desire. Otherwise, we'll see you next week. Robbie Slater, see you later. You're